You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Oliver Reihart, Director of Fellowship here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you all for today's special lunchtime talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Simon Sinek. Simon is the global best-selling author of Start With Why and Leaders Eat Last, which have helped organisations around the world inspire their people to reach new heights. He's presented his ideas to Fortune 100 companies and small startups, to non-profit organisations and members of Congress, to foreign ambassadors and the highest levels of the US military, among many others. His TED talk, based on Start With Why, is the third most popular video of all time on TED.com. Simon is fascinated by the people that make the greatest impact in their organisations and in the world. He's discovered some remarkable patterns in how they think, act and communicate, and the environments in which people operate at their natural best. In his new book, Together is Better, Simon has distilled many of these insights into a series of inspiring reflections on relationships, trust, teamwork, and what it means to each play our part in creating and building a shared vision and project. Something we're keenly interested in here at the RSA, of course. Please join me in welcoming Simon Sinek.
Thanks very much. So nearly every talk that I give and nearly every meeting that I have, someone will raise their hand and ask me the millennial question. Apparently, this young millennial generation is unleadable, and they frustrate everyone. They're accused of being entitled and narcissistic, and some have even accused them of being lazy. I think it's an unfair label. And I think the first sort of thing we do as great leaders is we're supposed to demonstrate empathy. And I think we've failed the millennial generation, which is we haven't demonstrated empathy, but rather have just accused them and expressed our frustrations. The funny thing is so many leaders are so frustrated by this generation that they've given up trying to lead them and now just ask them what they want. And they say beanbags and free food and flexible work hours and open work plans. And we give them all of that, and still nothing changes. So I've been able to sort of boil it down to four observations: parenting, technology, impatience, and environment. So let's start with parenting. Many amongst this generation, and the millennials are defined as a group of people born around the year 1984 and add another 20 years. Occasionally somebody asks me a question, you know, how to deal with Gen Z in their workforce. And the oldest Gen Z are probably around 14 years old, and you shouldn't have any of those in your workforce. That's a bigger problem. So many in this generation have been subject to what has been described as a failed parenting strategy. Many of them were raised being told that they were special and that they can have whatever they want just because they want it. Many of them got into advanced classes in schools not because they necessarily deserved it, but because their parents complained. And then may have even gotten better grades, not because they earned them, but because the teachers didn't want to deal with the parents. In the U.S., some have been given things called participation ribbons, which basically means you get a medal for coming in last. The idea being we don't want anybody to feel left out, and we want everybody to get a reward. The problem is it doesn't actually work, and the science on this is pretty decent. We know that it devalues the reward for the person who actually works hard and comes in first, and it actually is embarrassing for the person who knows they don't deserve it, and it actually makes them feel worse. And then they graduate, and they get a job, and instantly they discover they're not special. And instantly they discover that you can't have whatever you want just because you want it. You get nothing for coming in last, and your parents can't help you get a promotion. I've even heard stories of parents complaining that their kids didn't get a promotion. I've heard stories of parents filling out job applications, which is sort of astonishing. But in an instant, many in this generation have their entire self-image completely shattered immediately. And what that results in is it shakes their self-confidence. And so you have a disproportionately high number of people of an entire generation growing up with lower self-esteem, lower self-confidence than previous generations. And remember also, they've grown up in an Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook world where they're exceptionally good at filtering, presenting themselves as they want to be seen, curating their lives even. You know, every sunset looks a heck of a lot better on Instagram than it does in real life. In other words, they're very good at displaying how they want to be seen. So they sound tough, and they sound confident, and they say things like, ask us, we know, where the reality is they don't know, they're incredibly uncertain, they're incredibly unsure, and they don't want anybody to know. The second observation is technology. Now, we know when we engage with cell phones or with social media, we get a hit of a chemical called dopamine, right? Dopamine is the same chemical that makes us feel good when we find the thing we're looking for. You know, like, you know that little elation you get when you find your lost keys? Like, here they are! Like that feeling. Or when you hit the goal, yes, or win the game, did it, right? That little elation, that sort of feeling of good, that comes from this chemical called dopamine. That chemical is released when our phones go bing, buzz, flash, or beep. Right? It's why when we're feeling a little bit down or feeling a little bit sorry for ourselves, we send out 10 texts to 10 friends. Hi, 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 hi. Hoping to get a response because it actually makes us feel good. Right? Now, dopamine is the same chemical released in alcohol, nicotine, and gambling. And almost all addictions are dopamine-based addictions. Right? Now, we have age restrictions on alcohol, cigarettes, and gambling, because we know that a young developing mind is not yet strong enough to, it's not responsible enough as well, but not strong enough yet to deal with the addictive qualities of dopamine. So we restrict children from engaging in these things until they're older. But we have no such age restrictions on social media or mobile phones. So this is very dangerous, right? When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. That's all we need, right? And as we go through adolescence, we start to make this transition where we now crave the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the wider tribe. Very good, very important, right? It's a time of high anxiety and high stress, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and the numbing effects of dopamine that helps them cope with the stress of adolescence. That connection becomes hardwired. And so for the rest of their lives, when they suffer any kind of extreme stress, social stress, career stress, financial stress, they won't turn to a person, they'll turn to the bottle, right? Now, as I said before, social media and mobile phones also release dopamine, and we have no age restrictions on this open access. It's the equivalent of throwing open the liquor cabinet and telling our teenagers, try the vodka to help you get through your teenage years, right? And that's what's happening. Unfettered access to a highly, highly, highly addictive device, right? And like all addiction, in time, waste resources, and destroy relationships. In other words, there's an entire generation not only growing up with an addiction, but growing up with a lack of coping mechanisms. They haven't learned and aren't learning the social interactions that we need to learn to deal with stress in our later life. So what happens later on in their lives when they suffer stress, they're not turning to each other, they're not turning to people, they're turning to devices and they're turning to social media. And for some, their entire self-worth comes from how many followers they have, how many likes they get. It can be devastating if somebody unfollows them, right? And any kind of work stress, they're not going to people, right? Total lack of those coping mechanisms. I've talked to lots and lots and lots of millennials, high school kids, college kids, recent college grads, and they will admit to me, their words, not mine, that they struggle to form deep, meaningful relationships. They will freely admit that most of their friendships are superficial. They will freely admit that they wouldn't be surprised if their friends canceled on them because they got better plans somewhere else. And when that happens, there's no sense of how to deal with that stress. And so you have an insecure generation that doesn't have the coping mechanisms how to deal with the stress. And we're starting to see some of the impact of that. We're starting to see increase in suicide rates. We're starting to see increase in drug addiction and depression. Universities are dealing with an epidemic that they've never had to deal with ever before of students requesting leaves of absence due to depression. We're seeing the rise of sale of depression drugs. All of these kinds of things. Accidental deaths due to drug overdoses, these are all on the rise. Even mass homicide. In the United States, with over 120 school shootings in the past decade, something like 70% of them were perpetrated by kids born after the year 1980. Right? Gets worse. They're accused of being entitled. I think that's unfair. I think it's a misreading of the tea leaves. We're not considering the way in which they've grown up. They've grown up in a world of instant gratification. If you want to buy something, you go on Amazon and it shows up the next day. If you want to watch a movie, you don't check movie times. You simply log on and start streaming. You don't even have to wait week to week to week to watch a TV show. You just binge watch the whole weekend. Heck, if you want to go on a date, you just swipe right. Right? You don't even have to, like, learn the skills of, like, hey, right? And you never have to learn to say no when you mean yes, and yes when you mean no, and yes when you, like, it goes out the window, which only exaggerates those lack of social skills that's so important for all of us as social animals, right? The problem is they've applied the sense of instant gratification to all aspects of their lives, including career satisfaction and relationships. They go from relationship to relationship to relationship, and they go from job to job to job. I've sat down with some fantastic, smart, idealistic, hardworking, wonderful millennials, and I asked them, how's your job going? And they go, I think I'm going to quit. And I go, why? They say, I'm not making an impact. I'm like, you've been here 8 months, right? It's as if they're standing at the foot of a mountain and they can see the thing they want. They can see the summit, impact, or whatever it is that they want to do. What they can't see is the mountain, this large, immovable object. And this is not about doing your time. I don't care if you climb up the mountain or take a helicopter out up the mountain. I don't care. But there's no getting around the fact that you have to go up the mountain, right? They treat love or job fulfillment as if it's a scavenger hunt, something you look for. Like, I found love. It's like it's not under a rock, you know? Love is something you have to work very, very hard every single day to stay in love. It's not a discovery. And the same thing with job fulfillment and job satisfaction. Going from job to job to job to find this mythical thing called fulfillment, to feel like I'm making an impact. The problem is it's not something you find. It's something you work at every single day to enjoy. The act of taking care of those around you so that they will take care of you becomes fulfilling. And so the journey is what matters, not the summit. Career or life or relationship, whatever one you want to pick, is the journey. This very, very difficult uphill climb that has boulders and trees in the way. And sometimes there's an incredible view, and sometimes it's cloudy. And sometimes it's a straight path, and sometimes it's rocky. And the only way to get up the mountain is with the help of someone else. But if we aren't developing those skills, then we're going up the mountain alone, which feels really, really hard. Which gets to the fourth and most egregious of all the observations, which is environment. The standard corporate culture, the standard work environments that exist today are largely left over from the 80s and 90s. They're largely based on theories from decades ago, right? So the concept of shareholder supremacy, for example, was a theory proposed in the late 1970s, popularized in the 80s and 90s, and now is standard practice today. In fact, it's so standard, nobody even thinks about how dangerous it is, right? That's like a coach trying to build up a good team and prioritizing the needs of the fans over the needs of the players. That's what shareholder supremacy is. It's putting the needs of a disinterested external constituency over the people who actually have to do the work. That's what it is. And the origins of shareholder supremacy came from a different time when investors were installing professional executives into the companies in which they had invested, and they wanted to ensure that their investments would be protected, so they developed a new kind of incentive structure where they incentivized those executives based on the performance of the equity, not on the performance of the company, to protect their interests. And that's exactly what it does. It protects the interests of somebody who doesn't care. That is now normal, right? The use of mass layoffs, mass redundancies to balance the books did not exist prior to the 1980s. It was popularized in the 80s and 90s. Right? Think about that for a second. We're going to use the lives of human beings to balance the books. We're going to send someone home to say to their family, I can no longer provide because the company missed its arbitrary projections. That's what we're doing. And forget about the people we laid off. Think about the people who kept their jobs. Because every decision an organization makes is a piece of communication. And basically what the company announces every time they announce layoffs is that we care more about an abstract number than we do about you. That this is not a meritocracy. It doesn't matter how long or how hard you've worked here. If you happen to fall on the wrong side of the P&L, nothing personal, it's just business. That's what they tell us. Nothing personal, it's just business. There is nothing more personal than business. We will spend more time with our colleagues than our families. We will spend more time at work than we will at home. We will want to develop feelings of trust and cooperation with these people. No one wants to do business with somebody they don't trust. If somebody offers us a lower price but we don't trust them, we won't do business with them. We would rather do business with a handshake and no contract than a contract with no handshake. It's the most personal thing in the world. It's a lie to say nothing personal, it's just business. What it means is I've prioritized a number over you. That's what it means. And it completely destroys any trust or goodwill that has been built up inside the organization over the course of years. It's like cheating on someone you love. You spend years to build it up and you destroy it in one decision. And it is very difficult to build it back up again. And then you do it again the following year. And then you ask people to give their blood, sweat, and tears, and you're trying to say we're building a culture of innovation. And people ask me this question all the time. Simon, how do we get the most out of our people? Like they're a towel that we just, you know, just one drop more, right? What a terrible thing to ask. That's like saying, how do you get the most out of your children? Ugh, right? How do we help our people perform at their natural best? That's the question leaders should be asking, but aren't. The concept of rank and yank, popularized in the 80s and 90s, where we rank the performance of our employees based on their contribution to stock price, and we promote the top 10% and fire the bottom 10%, and we pit people against each other inside the company, all with the idea that that's helping performance, right? These theories were good for a different time. The 80s and 90s were boom years. With relative peace, a kinder, gentler Cold War. We weren't practicing drills hiding under our desks back then. Those times are gone. These are no longer boom years. This is not a time of relative peace. And the internet and globalization has made business that much more complicated. And the theories of business that worked then just do not work now. And it can be seen in the scandals that we see at VW or Wells Fargo or Tesco's. What happens when we prioritize numbers over people? Those are just extreme examples. Less extreme examples is just entire organizations of people who don't love going to work, who don't really trust each other, who don't really feel safe. And if you ask them, how's your job? Nobody says, amazing. Nobody says, I love what I do. What you generally hear is, it's fine. You know, same old, it's fine. Pays the bills. That's become our normal. And the problem is if you take a young generation that has lower self-confidence than previous generations, a lack of social skills on how to build relationships, a lack of coping mechanisms on how to deal with stress, and an impatience that they want all of their problems and bad feelings to go away immediately. And then you put them in a work environment that actually doesn't care about them as human beings, doesn't care about their growth. It's not going to go well. Not only does it not help business, it's not helping an entire generation. And whether we like it or not, we have no choice. Companies have a higher responsibility now than they've ever had. They were dealt a bad hand. The millennials were dealt a bad hand. And they have to play the hand they were dealt. So we've been dealt the same hand. We cannot complain. We have to help them build their confidence. We have to teach them patience. We have to help them learn social skills and coping mechanisms. We don't have a choice. The problem is, it's almost missing in most companies. How many companies can say that their leaders care more about their personal growth than they do about the company's growth? Or how many companies can brag that they have a communications course that teaches us how to listen actively and how to have constructive confrontation? And look at the use of cell phones inside companies. Right? Let me borrow someone's phone. Can I borrow a phone, please? Let me show you something. What if I were to hold my phone while I'm talking to you? It's not binging, it's not buzzing, it's not beeping, and I'm not checking it. I'm simply holding it. Do you feel like you're the most important thing to me right now? No, you do not. And this is an artificial environment. So when we're walking down the halls and somebody says, can I ask you a question? We go, sure, what's on your mind? We've just said, not that important. The thing to do is to go like this. Sure, what's on your mind? And if you don't have a pocket, find a shelf, put it down and say, sure, what's on your mind? There's a subconscious reaction to the device, right, that tells people when they see it that they're just not that important to us. So when we show up to lunch or dinner with colleagues or family or a meeting, and the first thing we do is put our phones on the table, we've announced to everyone in the room, everyone sitting at the table, you're not, just not that important to me right now. And turning the phone upside down is not more polite. My favorite one is sitting in a meeting and the phone rings and the caller ID shows up and the person will lean over in the middle of the meeting, go like this and go, I'm not going to get it. Magnanimous, right? And that's part of the problem. We're just as addicted as they are. And we ourselves are doing damage not only to the relationships we're forming, but we're really doing harm to the people we supposedly care about and are concerned about. Right? We have to act accordingly. We have to model behavior. We keep telling them, you're the future leaders. And what they have forgotten to tell us is, yeah, but you're the leaders now. Well, you're going to build the future. Yeah, but you're screwing up our future now. Right? We have to model behavior. And this is part of the thing that we often forget. That great culture, no matter where we are, no matter how big the organization, is not about intensity, it's about consistency. Right? You can't get into shape by going to the gym for 9 hours. It won't work. But if you work out every single day for 20 minutes, you will absolutely get into shape. Right? Intensity is like going to the dentist. It's fixed in time, we know exactly what date we're going, we know how long we're going to be there. We know we'll be there for approximately an hour, right? And we know that when we come out, our teeth will feel smooth and look pearly. And we do it twice a year. But if that's all we do, all our teeth will fall out. In other words, intensity is not enough. So we're also supposed to brush our teeth twice a day for 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes in the evening. What does brushing your teeth do for 2 minutes? Nothing. It does absolutely nothing unless you do it every single day. Can you leave out a day? Sure. How many days can you leave out? I don't really know. How many times do you have to brush your teeth before it works? I don't know that either. How long does it take to get into shape? I don't know. I know it takes more than a week. But I also know that if you've been doing the same thing for a year and you see no results, you're probably doing something wrong. I just don't know where or how long it takes. And this is why companies don't do it. Because we like intensity. We like things that are fixed in time and easily measured. We want to make leaders. What do? We have a company offsite. We invite a whole bunch of speakers. Everybody gives the event an 8.5. Leaders. No. No. We like intensity. How do we fix broken companies? Reorg. New management. Aha. We can see the results. Layoffs. We love it. Look at the savings. Yeah, in the short term. We love intensity for the simple reason that it's easy to measure and we can calculate the day, we can calculate the time, highly predictable. But it's consistency that is the human part. You know, what does it take to fall in love? Buy her flowers, remember her birthday. You know, important. But if that's all you do, it won't work. It's the little things. Like when you wake up in the morning, you say good morning to her before you check your phone. When you get up to get yourself a drink, you bring one back without asking if they even wanted one. When they're having a bad day and you had a great day, you put your excitement aside to hear about their bad day. When you're watching the game and they say, honey, can I talk to you? You hit pause, you say, what's on your mind? Idealistically. Let's not go crazy. I am an idealist. Any one of those things does nothing. It's the accumulation of all of those things done over the course of time repeatedly that one day someone will wake up and go, oh my God, I love you. It's the exact same thing in a company, which is we do these things repeatedly, which is instead of waiting for Charlie to show up at the meeting who's running a few minutes late, and we're all just on our phones waiting for Charlie, he's just running, is he here, just a few more minutes, okay. Oh, Charlie's here, good, let's start the meeting. Instead, we should have no phones in conference rooms ever, because you know what happens? We sit in the room and we talk. We go, I heard your mum's in the hospital. Oh, yeah, thanks, no, she's much better, thanks for asking, yeah, yeah. Hey, what happened with that client? Oh my God, total disaster, right? And we talk. And that's called building relationships. What does it do? Nothing. It does nothing. But if you do it on a regular basis over the course of time, what ends up happening is you discover that you trust your colleagues, that you love your boss, that you believe to the core of your being that if something is wrong, that they will be there for you. And what starts to happen is you start to be willing to be vulnerable. Vulnerable doesn't mean walking around crying. That's not what it means. What vulnerable means is I'm willing to raise my hand and say, I made a mistake. I'm not qualified for the job that you gave me. I'm scared. I don't know what I'm doing. I need help. Without any fear that by revealing those things, will you be humiliated or fired or get in trouble? That's what this means. We owe that to this generation. They should feel the intense joy of what it means to be in an organization where people love them and care about them as human beings, where we care about helping them build their confidence, where we care about teaching them the social skills they need to enjoy life and build strong friendships and relationships, where they can deal with stress in healthy ways. We owe it to them. And here's the joke. It's good for business, because these are the people who are going to be working with us and working for us and taking over the companies. It all starts with empathy. It all starts with empathy. And I think all of us can contribute a little bit more to helping an amazing, idealistic, hardworking, fantastic generation feel understood. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. That's a very fascinating talk, inspiring talk. I feel like I should re-examine my parenting skills the moment I finish this meeting. There's one thing, it was quite interesting that you started talking about this generation, the generation coming up now, mm-hmm. and then moved on to how companies should change mm-hmm. to help them. How at an earlier stage in life, in schools, parents?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see all of that.
Okay.
I would love to see parenting, some of the parenting strategies that were popularized, 15, 20 years ago, go away. Absolutely. Schools do have a higher burden and should also recognize that maybe digitizing everything, not necessarily a good idea. Mm. Marketers, I think, are some of the worst offenders because marketers love to report trend data as if it's truth, as if it's good, right? Like, kids these days are using apps for everything. We should make more apps. No. It's just a trend, right? It's like in the 80s, you needed cocaine to get through the workday. It doesn't mean give them more cocaine. It's just a trend. It's just a trend. It's not necessarily something we should, fuel. So, but that's, you're talking about another generation who's still in school. This Gen Y, they're out of school. They're working. Some of them are in the early 30s already. They're already in management positions. So companies have to pick up the slack. We have no choice.
And in fact, I was talking to a colleague of mine earlier today, and she was talking about trying to do some of these things in the company, not this one, not the RSA, who I work for, but another company, saying that actually she struggled because her boss and the culture just didn't allow it, and in the end, it just didn't happen. So what would you say to those people who are perhaps in that middle management who are struggling with this?
I get that question an uncomfortably high number of times, which is, what do I do when my boss doesn't get it, right? And the answer is, you ignore them, right? We cannot control that which we cannot control. We cannot influence the behavior of people we can't influence. The only thing we can take responsibility for is our own actions. And so instead of playing the victim or indicting someone else, First of all, let's have empathy. We don't understand the stresses that they're under. Maybe they also feel like they're not qualified for the jobs they have. I don't know. But we need to be the leaders we wish we had, right? Leadership has nothing to do with rank. Rank is simply authority. That's all it is. I know of many people who sit at the highest levels of organizations who are not leaders. We do as they tell us because they have authority over us, but we wouldn't choose to follow them. We certainly don't trust them. And yet I know many people in lower ranks of organizations who have no authority, but they've made a choice. The choice to look after the person to the left of them, and the choice to look after the person to the right of them, and we would trust them and follow them anywhere, right? So we need to be that person, which is we need to take care and take care of the people around us. So we have an entire section in our bookshop called self-help. We have no section in our bookshop called help others, right? And at the end of the, we have such a selfish bunch. Like, how can I lose 10 pounds? Like, how can I find the job of my dreams? You know, how can I find love? As opposed to how can I help somebody I care about find a lifetime of bliss? And how can I help somebody I care about find a job, a life of fulfillment from their work? How can I help somebody else live a healthy lifestyle? And this is what great leaders do. They commit themselves to the growth and success of those to the left of them and to the right of them. And every one of us can choose to be that person if we want.
Indeed, yeah. Is there any questions from the audience? If
Hi, my 8-year-old son came home last night and he said that he wanted to be elected by his peers to be on the school council. Cool. I wasn't exactly sure, so he's not that confident. He's a bit younger in the class, but I wasn't sure what advice I should give him into become a leader in front of his 8-year-old peers.
Oh,
so
sure.
You want to start young.
Yeah, so I love that he's doing that. So the question is, what is the reason he wants to? You know? If it's because he wants people to like him, not a good enough reason, right? What's the reason he wants his peers to elect him to student council? What kind of school does he want to build that doesn't exist now? What kind of experience does he want his peers to have that they're not having now? What kind of change would he like to have that he thinks others would benefit from that they're not getting now? In other words, what's the reason he's doing this? And if he can help him put that into words, we can write that on posters, we can write speeches, and he can go around and tell everybody, I imagine a school in which we, right? Which is great grammar, too. And those who believe in his vision will vote for him. It doesn't matter if he's a little younger or a little shorter, right? Because we're drawn to the vision, and we want leadership desperately. We all want that. You know, it's desperately lacking in our world today, which is somebody who's offering us a vision of a future state that does not yet exist, that we can imagine. You know, we get a lot of reactive things, and I'm crime, environment, whatever, you know, which is all good stuff, but it's all tactical. So help him put into words what his imagination, why it's, and explain to him it's going to be hard work, and some people will disagree with you, and you'll have to do work after school, and is it going to be, like, what is it all worth? Like, why is that worth it? All the extra work you're going to have to do. And if he can find those words, he can tell everybody else his vision.
Hi. Brilliant to hear you, Simon. I teach undergraduate business students, and I show them your video, Start With Why, which they really love your circle thing.
Thank you.
And then I ask them, can you sit down?
That was the run-up name, by the way.
Yes, sorry.
Circles on.
The thing is, though... I say, do you like that video? And they go, yeah, and they all nod their heads. Then I tell them, sit down and talk about it and what it means. And they really struggle. Mm. What would you do?
I would push the conversation. I wouldn't let them off the hook. And I would ask, so here's the irony of the question why. It's actually an emotional question that elicits an emotional answer because it goes to the limbic brain. Why are you home late? Shut up, Dad, right? What you want to do is ask a what question, which is a rational question, which gets them to think. What were you doing that you were home late? And I'll tell you. So ask them, what specifically about that talk made you say, I like it? I don't know. Well, you said you like it. So tell me what specifically you liked. Was there something specifically in there that you perked up and said, that's me, that's my life? I would not let them off the hook, but reframe the question.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's emotional, which is why they can't answer it, by the way. That's why they're struggling, because it's a feeling.
I was interested to hear you speak about intensity, and that reminds me that my biggest complaint about any government is that everything seems to be done in such I call it soundbite politics.
Yep. Yep.
It's all for the short term, for voting in the next election. Nothing is long term.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please advise the government? quite quickly.
My door is open. I'm accepting calls. Yes, I mean, your answer is 100% right. And I think, again, I've actually stopped blaming politicians, to be honest. I now firmly believe that we get the politicians we deserve, right? I think they're a mirror reflection of us.
Well, not us here at the RSA,
no, not
obviously.
Us here, but clearly. but of, you know, of our society, that they're not the selfish, narcissistic, short-term, you know, self-interested ones. We're the narcissistic, self-interested, short-term ones. And not until we start being open-minded to the opinions of those with whom we disagree will they ever be open-minded to the opinions of those who disagree. Not until we start prioritizing the group over our self-interests will they. So if you just look at the way we function in business, the way we're building companies, the way we treat each other, right, we're the divided ones. And so I think we need to take some accountability for ourselves and stop playing the victims to our politicians. I think if we fix us, then they will. It goes away. I think, you know, the problem is it's not going to happen overnight. It's not an intensity model. That's an election. It's going to take a little bit of time, but it's worth it. So it might hurt for a little bit, but it won't hurt forever.
But do you think that will actually happen? I mean, it feels a bit chicken and egg. That,
well, somebody's got to go first.
Yeah.
So if we wait for them, we'll wait forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got to pick a strategy. So I say, it goes back to the question of what do I do with my boss who doesn't get it? Well, take responsibility for your own self and your own ability to lead. Well, let's take responsibility for our own citizenship and build the country we want as opposed to waiting for someone else to do it.
Next question. Yeah.
Thank you. Simon, I just want to ask you about empathy. Because in relational skills, I see the other side of it, the opposite of empathy, to be courage, to actually put yourself out into areas where you don't feel comfortable, where you normally would, etc.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think engendering courage within our workforce, I think, is important,
mm-hmm.
and not to be so threatened by that,
mm-hmm.
as narcissistic managers.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering about your views on how to engender courage, mm-hmm. within workforce.
I'm not sure I agree with the premise that courage is the opposite of empathy. I think the opposite of empathy is not empathy. I think courage is actually the result of empathy. You can comment on this, which is courage is not some deep internal fortitude. You can dig down deep and find the courage, right? It comes from outside sources, right? So the reason we have courage to do things is because somebody says to us, I've got your back. I believe in you, right? I've had the opportunity to meet people in uniform who've risked their lives for others. They did things that they wouldn't have been ordered to do, and no one would have faulted them if they didn't do it, and they did it anyway. And I asked them, why did you do it? You have families, you have kids, like, why did you do it? And they all give me the same answer, because they would have done it for me, right? And I think, like, a trapeze artist would never try a brand new death-defying act without a net. Right? That net is empathy. And that's where the courage comes from to try the new thing. And at the risk of belaboring the point, I'll share a story that I think really, really sort of captures it for me. Navy SEALs, when they become Navy SEALs, have to go through a selection process called BUDS, which is they have to lift telephone poles and sit in freezing cold water, and it's really awful. And most of them drop out because it's really hard. And somebody asked a SEAL, who makes it through BUDS? And he said, I can't tell you who makes it through, but I can tell you who doesn't make it through. He said, the preening leader who likes to delegate everything, none of those guys make it through. He said, the star college athlete who's never really been tested to the core of his being, none of those guys make it through. Some of these guys with bulging muscles covered in tattoos who want to show you how tough they are, none of them make it through. He says, some of the guys who make it through are skinny and scrawny. He said, some of the guys who make it through, you'll see them shivering out of fear. He says, but all of the guys who make it through, when they're physically exhausted, when they're emotionally exhausted, somehow, some way, they're able to dig down deep inside of themselves to find the energy to help the guy next to them. In other words, our most elite warriors, our highest performing human beings on the planet, are not the strongest, they're not the fastest, they're the most empathetic. So I think courage comes directly from the feeling we have that somebody has our back. Right?
Thank you very much. I have a theory that company balance sheets completely fail to reflect how people really feel about them.
Yeah.
And that's one of the major problems of organisations, that they're focused on the hard rather than the soft.
Yeah.
So you talked about Tesco's or Sainsbury's, you know, they don't realise that they're making money out of actually creating all sorts of other problems that people feel deeply uncomfortable with.
Well, they do know
it.
They choose to ignore it.
They choose to ignore it.
Yeah.
Well, they don't know it at an organisational level and a senior management level, otherwise they do something about
Fair
it.
Fair enough.
How do you correct what is clearly an endemic problem across all businesses, which is the way companies represent themselves through their accounts?
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of answers, a couple of thoughts that come to mind anyway. One is we have unbalanced metrics. There's nothing wrong with measuring performance in numbers. It's just incomplete, right? It's unbalanced. Like, there's nothing wrong with measuring how well our kids do at school. We measure their grades. But we also want to know what kind of kid they are, like what kind of character they have, and do they treat each other nicely, you know? Like, balance. So, coincidence, it's another Navy SEAL story. There's about 2,500 guys on the SEALs, and I'm like 300 guys on SEAL Team 6. So it's the best. And when they're evaluating who gets on SEAL Team 6, they look at two axes. They look at performance, and they look at trust. Of course, nobody wants this person, the low performer of low trust, of course. Of course, everybody wants this person, the high performer of high trust. What they learned is that this person up here in the upper left quadrant, the high performer of low trust, is a toxic leader. And they would rather have a medium performer of high trust, even sometimes a low performer of high trust, it's a relative scale, over the high performer of low trust, right? In business, we have a million metrics to measure someone's performance, and we have negligible to no metrics to measure someone's trustworthiness. So sometimes we are promoting the wrong people, not because we're bad or because we're sort of don't get it, but we literally lack the information, and so we promote the highest performers that can actually continue to perpetuate what you're talking about, right? The joke is that it's unbelievably easy to find out who those people are. You simply ask the people on the team with whom they work, who's the best, and they'll all point to the same person. Right? But we don't do peer reviews. The only kind of reviewing we do is one person, your boss, telling you how well you did. So you kiss up, you get a good review. We don't ask our peers how well we're doing relative to each other. And that is way more powerful for social animals to be recognized by our peers than simply by our bosses. It's way more powerful. And that's all about values and integrity and how we are, not how well we perform, right? So I think we're missing metrics to give leadership clear. Because I think if some of them had the data, they probably wouldn't promote half the people they do, right? So I don't necessarily just instantly blame them. That's number one. Number two, I adhere to the law of diffusion of innovations like it's religion. Right, which is law of diffusion of innovation says at all populations we sift over the standard deviation. Right, this over here you have the innovators and the early adopters, the majority and the laggards. Right, so what we're talking about, what you're raising, is how do we influence the laggards and the late majority? The answer is you don't. They are coming to the party a little bit slower. So we, instead of railing against the ones who don't get it, don't want to get it, we find the ones who are like, huh, that's interesting. I'm open to that. Even if it's for business reasons, which is they understand that it's actually builds a stronger, higher performing business, what we're talking about. Like, this is not all kumbaya, like, let's light a campfire and love each other. This actually is good for business. And so let's ignore the ones who give us a hard time. Let's find the ones who are open to changing their business models, experimenting and tweaking. And if we get the critical mass, it tips, just like it did from the 80s and 90s. Like, what the 80s and 90s did was eat a cheeseburger every day. And it went the wrong way. Now we have to eat celery every day, right? Like, small amounts of good behavior yield good cultures over the course of time, but small amounts of bad behavior will destroy things over the course of time as well, right? So we have to have the patience to change it over the next bunch of years, but it's not by being angry at those who don't get it. We simply say, okay, we'll get you next time. You'll come along.
And do you have any examples, if you could pick one or two companies you feel have really got it?
It's many of the companies that I write about. Barry Waymiller and NextJump and WD-40, fantastic company. And it's public, so that's a rare one, right? A public company that does things right. And when you talk to Gary Ridge, who's the CEO, he will very happily say, if they want to invest in me, invest in me. If you don't, don't. But I'm not changing the way I treat my people. I'm not changing the way I'm building my culture. In other words, he has the courage to basically stand up to Wall Street. He understands that they're in a game of quarters or less, and he's in the game of years and decades. And so he understands he's not going to take advice from people who, if his company's doing well, they're going to invest him in anyway. Fair-weathered fans. So I admire him and his company a lot, especially because they're public. I know a lot of CEOs who regret going public, wish they could buy their companies back but can't afford it. And I would bet close to 100% of CEOs of public companies will all admit in private how much they hate public companies. Publicly, they're all like, drives the economy, right? But privately, they all hate it. The stress is overwhelming, and they know it's stupid. They're smart people. No CEO of a public company likes Wall Street.
Thank you very much for the talk and for the answers to the questions. They're also so good. I was hoping that I'd be lucky enough to ask a question, an important question about what I should do in my life, because I get a brilliant answer. I've got something that's sort of related.
No pressure.
Sort of ticks the box. But I think it also maybe speaks to what you're asking for. Is this what you're asking for in terms of leadership? Is this what you're asking for from businesses? I had the opportunity to meet Eric Schmidt from Google a couple of weeks ago, and he'd just given a lecture at the LSE about computers and education and computer science and entrepreneurship and how the government needed to invest in all those things. Mm-hmm. So I helpfully went up to him afterwards and said, what about tax? He didn't really want to have the conversation, but he'd had a great time because he loves computers and he talked about computers for an hour, and the audience loved hearing about it. And I didn't really want to like him, but I did.
Sure.
He's very articulate and very brilliant.
Sure.
So I said, can I ask you about tax? And I've worked with businesses on tax and with NGOs on tax. I've concluded that there is a better answer. So this is what I said to him. Instead of saying we pay what is required by law, if you want us to pay more tax, change the law. Mm-hmm. I said, you got a better answer than that. And he was looking at me, and I was looking at him. And I was like, am I really saying this to this guy? And he's like, go on then. What if you said the tax system is not fit for purpose? It's not sustainable. We can't have nation states beggar themselves and beggar their neighbours by reducing the corporate tax rate around the world. You've been in this lecture theatre talking about investing in education and entrepreneurship and computer sciences, etc. Why don't you say...
You're way out of my comfort zone.
Why don't you say...
I haven't known anything about tax.
We recognise that. We recognise the system of taxation is not sustainable.
Yeah.
Business needs to be part of making the world a better place.
Yeah.
We need. We're Google. We're enormous. We've got all these brains, all these resources. Yeah. We can be part of trying to fix it, and we can work with others, and we can say we've got to come up with a better system of taxation. We'll pay what the lawyers say in terms of tax for now, but for the future, we need a better system.
How can I help?
We're going to want to be part of that. And I guess I'm asking, thank you for the prompt there, I've come to an end. It was for leadership. I was asking him to take a leadership position on this and say it's not just enough to be so amazing at so many different things, and it's a very admirable company.
Sure.
We need more. And in terms of tax, he could say that if that's what he wanted, if that's where we wanted to place
Google. You're saying that if he has this, he should lead. He should get Google to solve a problem.
If I bring it back to my problem, he said, speak to this guy. So he pointed to the head of comms for EMEA, and this guy hasn't replied to my emails. Yeah. So that's where we are with this.
I don't know.
I thought I made a good case to him. He understood it. Yeah. He looked at me, he nodded his head.
I mean this sincerely, right? I think that you will have a stronger time, it'll be a better time at convincing others if you can articulate what your vision is more concisely, right? Because it's taking a long time for us to understand. In other words, you're thinking out loud, which is fine, but I would spend the time to go write down or record into a tape recorder everything you're saying, or sit down with a friend and make the whole argument, get it all out, right? And then ask yourself about this whole thing, to what end? So what? That you can get down to a sentence or two and nothing else. Because what you're saying may be true, but it's tactical. Or what you're saying may be true, but it's the argument, it's not the vision, right? So I'll give you me, for example, right? If I want to go, if I have this conversation with somebody, I will walk up and say, I imagine a world in which the vast majority of people wake up every single morning, inspired to go to work, feel safe when they're there, and return home fulfilled at the end of the day. What I want to know is, how can you help build a tax code to help build the world that I imagine? Done. Right? But I had to go through the pain of getting all of it out to be able to say that. Okay. Okay. Food for thought.
My name is Philippa. I'm a smartphone-aholic. Thank you.
Hi, Philippa.
Hi. there is clearly a problem that we're all addicted to some extent, and we know we're doing naughty things, and we do put our phones down, I believe, sometimes. But there's a generation below us who are... they don't know a life without these phones. You mentioned it's a trend. So a trend would come to an end. What do you see? How do you see that happening right now?
Because if we do not intervene, which is what we're saying, right? If we leave it go, and in other words, if I don't rail against it, and I'm not talking about getting rid of technology. I think it's fine. It's about balance. Mm-hmm. I think it's unbalanced. You know, I think it's a problem if you wake up and check your phone before you say good morning to somebody. You know. So if we don't intervene, we don't label it an addiction, we continue to raise kids by giving them unfettered access to little devices, right, without any restriction. If we do all that, what happens? I think all the trends that I talked about become epidemic. So suicide becomes epidemic. Drug addiction becomes epidemic, right? I'm already seeing it. I have a friend who's she's 28, and she came over, and we were working at my place, and it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she opens up her bag and she pops an Adderall, and I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, I'm taking an Adderall. I'm like, why? She's like, because I'm having trouble concentrating. I'm like, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, everybody has trouble concentrating, right? But this is the problem, which is a generation that's been told, like, you got to be productive, an unfair standard that they don't even get the circadian rhythms of productivity and lack of productivity, that you can have a bad day and you can have a great day. Like, I'm sitting back going, oh, I'm useless now, you know? But she actually thinks it's her. She thinks her brain is broken, right? That will continue, and we will see addiction to prescription drugs go haywire, because people will not realize that they're fine, and they'll treat every little thing with a pill rather than with a person, right? Like, if you're a little bit depressed, talk to someone. Sometimes, in extreme cases, absolutely, medications are required, but not every case. Most cases, you just need somebody to listen, and you go, thank you, I feel heard.
So do you think we could set up a smartphones anonymous...
Oh, I would love that.
Helpline.
I would love that.
I haven't looked at my phone for an hour.
I think we should treat. I think we should treat phones like cigarettes, like smokers, which is you can make as many calls as you want, you can send as many texts as you want outside, right? At least smokers go out together. At least they're social. At least they talk. You know, I never thought I'd be promoting smoking, but my goodness, it's at least a little more social. I hear that some people smoke to meet people, like it's a dating thing. Yeah. How old-fashioned.
Hello, fantastic talk. I went to a meeting in the City of London the other day, Canary Wharf, and it was on mindfulness in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I was full of a room of corporate people. It's absolutely packed.
Yeah.
So it's something that's happening.
Yeah.
And I was full of feeling, that's with believers, and I'm a bit sceptical.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone problem came up, one person said, yeah, people are holding their phones under the desk, not in the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Mindfulness will solve that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, alarm bells, you may be just creating a corporate performance tool and mind chains with this Yeah. It could be twisted the wrong way around. Well, have you any comment on that?
Well, I mean, when you're a hammer, every problem's a nail. Look, I think mindfulness is great, and I'm all for it. I think it suffers two problems. One is packaging. It's called mindfulness. Right? It sounds kind of hippie to me. Right? And I think when people start talking about mindfulness, the converted are like, yeah, and anybody sort of on the border is like, And even if they're curious, like their social reputations wouldn't allow them, like, if you're a big corporate titan, to go to your mindfulness class, right? So I just think it needs repackaging, right? So that's where I came up with the concept of why, by the way, because purpose sounded too ooey-gooey, and I got tired of having debates with people about what comes first, vision or mission, because there's no standardized definition. So I asked the people who believe mission comes first, what's mission? They said, it's why our company exists. And I asked the people who believe vision was preeminent, and I said, what's vision? They said, it's why we get out of bed in the morning. And purposes is whatever. They all had the same definition. So I said, we'll call it the why, we can all agree. Now we can have a conversation, right? So one of the other problems is it's just poorly packaged. Why don't we call it focus? Everybody wants that, right? Concentration. Like, whatever you want to call it, the techniques are all the same, but we don't have to be so precious about the name. We can call it what works. That's number one. The other thing is, in our selfish modern day and age, I enjoy the irony of how selfish we've become about mindfulness. Let me elaborate. I went to a meeting a few months ago, and there was somebody in the meeting who is a sort of well-known, well-regarded yoga instructor from some fancy yoga school. And she sat next to me on her phone almost the entire meeting, and I was watching. It was like Instagram, texting. Like, it wasn't like anything constructive for that moment. And at one point, while we were all talking and she was looking down, she looked at me and says, it's why I love yoga. It helps me be present. And that's when I realized you don't get to decide when you're being present. Yoga, mindfulness, meditation, all of these things are simply tools so that we can be present in the company of others. You are not present until somebody else says you are. The practice of mindfulness is a tool you can use so that someone will say of you, I feel like you're listening. Meditation is a tool that you can use so that what someone will say of you, I feel like you're here with me. I feel like you're being present. Because when you meditate, you close your eyes and you try and focus on nothingness, you're like, it's a thought, put it out of my head, I'll come tap, you know? Well, when you're with somebody and they're talking and you have a head full of thoughts, you'll be like, there's a difference between listening and waiting for your turn to speak, you know? And the reality is, good meditation practice will help you put your own thoughts out of your head to focus on their thoughts. In other words, they're simply tools. But we don't get to declare when we're being present. Oh, I'm so present right now. Right. You're present when I say you are, right? And that's part of the problem I have with mindfulness, is it's kind of like, look at me, you know? But it is just a tool, a valuable tool like many other tools.
We've got time for one last quick question.
Do you have any quick tips for one's personal life on how to be more present when juggling work, small children, friends, emails, sometimes all at the same time?
Women are better at it than men. True. It's about prioritizing, right? And it's the very, very hard task of forcing ourselves to focus on one thing at a time. So if I'm with work, I'm with work. And if somebody says, I need you, be like, just give me a second, I got to finish this, right? If we're with friends, we're 100% with friends. Now, it's an imperfect system, I know that. But it is a practice. It is the practice of giving full attention to the thing we're with, because at the end of the day, there's no such thing as multitasking. You can do one thing brilliantly, two things pretty well, three things not that well, and anything more is just a mess. And college professors will tell you this, which is they see a complete decline in the writing quality of students these days. And what they'll see, and we see it in the business world too, the most junior people in the companies that I work with, they give me stuff that they've written, and it's absolutely appalling, right? And what they'll do is they'll write a brilliant paragraph, and a brilliant paragraph, and a brilliant paragraph, and none of it is connected. It's because they write, check, write, check, write, check. It's this on-off, on-off, on-off. You know, I walk through offices and I love looking. You can tell the generation, an older generation has their phone over here and the young generation has their phone over here. It's literally working like this. And the analogy I like to give, I know you asked for something short. The analogy I like to give is, imagine if you're sitting working at your desk and the rule is that I can ring a bell whenever I want. I can ring it every second, I can ring it every minute, I can ring it every hour, I can do whatever I want randomly, right? And at the moment I ring the bell, you have to get up and go to the fridge. How much work do you think you can get done? That's our mobile phone, right? So we're kidding ourselves. And for the young generation to say, no, 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 we grew up with it, so we're better multitaskers, uh-uh. The performance empirically shows that that's just not the case. So no one can multitask. So I think it's just the practice of...
So self-discipline.
The practice. And having somebody help you, call you on it. Put your phone away, please. I thought you were talking to me. Like, that kind of stuff helps.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, actually. Very good note. And you do have a book out, Together is Better. If anyone comes to these talks regularly, people who've tended to publish a new book and bring it along, it's normally a weighty tome full of lots of words that takes hours, whereas this is refreshingly short and has beautiful pictures and is a little book of inspiration for everyday life.
So can I just point out one thing?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to practice what I preach, right? So I wrote a book that was hard to digitize because it's got colored pictures. The American version is centered. And it's designed, the very, very first page says to and from. It's designed to be given away. I wrote it so that we will all have something to give to somebody we want to inspire or give to somebody to thank them for inspiring us. It is designed to help us improve relationships. So there you go.
Fantastic. There you go. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.